Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Welcome back to the Source Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Matt Kinnear and Kevin Brown. Hopefully, you listened to our return from our sabbatical earlier this week as we talked about the top 20 teams in the Inside Lacrosse preseason media poll. And we are back to talk about all the things that you have missed since the 2022 NCAA Championship game when Luke Wehrman and the Maryland Terrapins exacted their redemption story in incredible fashion. Kevin Brown, you memorialized that with your 23 preseason hype video. Tell us about your inspiration.
Well, the inspiration was exactly that. The Luke Wehrman redemption story was something to behold. The rise from taking that last shot of the 21 season to getting absolutely stonewalled, point blank range. Incredible ending. One of the best championships of the last several years, in my opinion, in that Virginia game, even though Terps lost. And they come back, and he's the one of the driving forces behind one of the all-time great seasons is pretty remarkable comeback story.
And the reason I think it's a good place to start this podcast is because certainly the most important things that have happened in the last 8 months since we played college lacrosse are things that we don't know about. It's players getting better, coaches devising new schemes, chemistry developing, etc. But ultimately, because we don't know about it, we can't talk about it. So instead, we're here to talk about the things that we do know about. And in my opinion, there is one indisputably more significant thing than all the rest that has happened since last we met. Matt Kinnear, earlier this month, Bill Tierney announced that he is going to retire after the 2023 season. He is the most legendary coach in the history of college lacrosse, the only coach to win Division I NCAA championships at two institutions, and he will call it quits after this season with the Denver Pioneers. What was your reaction when you heard this news?
Yeah, Bill Tierney, you know, announced that it's going to be his last season, and, you know, everyone knew it was coming at some point. The way that it happened, you know, when it happened in the moment, it was shocking, but then as you thought about it, it kind of just made exact perfect sense and exactly how Bill Tierney would want to, you know, be memorialized, you know, having it happen on his own terms, so to speak. You know, he controlled the message, you know, he got it out there. He was able to tell it to his team. He was able to do it and get it out of the way before the season starts. He's not going to be able to kind of control the victory lap that he gets to take throughout the season, but it's enough time where, you know, he could say what he wants to say and then focus on the season and then end it that way. So it very much was like shocking that it happened, because especially because of his contract situation where he had another year on his contract. But in retrospect, it was the exact Bill Tierney way for him to do it. And, you know, I'll kind of go in a little bit about, you know, Bill Tierney and, you know, talking to him in this press conference that he had in the days after that, you know, we announced that he was going to be stepping down after this season. And, you know, Bill Tierney is just, he's the consummate coach. He, if he wasn't coaching lacrosse, he'd be coaching some sort of basketball dynasty. He'd be coaching some sort of soccer dynasty. He would be coaching somewhere and he would be succeeding at a super high level. He just has this knack for getting as much out of you as you possibly can, more out of you than you think you could, you know, even get out of yourself. So, you know, there's the stories about, you know, he mentioned the story about the what he was coaching in New York girls basketball, which was one of the three sports that he was coaching at in high school level there, and they lost by 72 points. He took the job that, you know, to get into college coaching. But it's just so remarkable of how, you know, you think of him at Johns Hopkins, where he coached soccer and he took a women's soccer team to the NCAA tournament. That's just an insane level, and it kind of bridges a gap. And what Bill Tierney did better than anyone else is, you know, lacrosse, he was coaching lacrosse when the profession was such a different thing than it is now. You know, now it's a little more, I'm not saying it's football in the sense of it's not akin to multi-million dollar salaries, but it's more like football in terms of the athletic support and everything that goes with it, the recruiting, you know, throughout the year and stuff. And, you know, Bill Tierney took it from when it was, you know, kind of phys ed teachers who, you know, wanted to coach their high school who got into college and took it to a new level. So he was part of that movement. And one thing that I kept coming back to with the way that Princeton was the dynasty in the 90s, and then with what he did at Denver, he was kind of, in many ways, the focal point of the sport during its most explosive period of transformation and growth. So there's possibly no one who has had to be the face of the sport in a sense of explaining what lacrosse is to a mainstream media outlet than Bill Tierney. As the head coach of Princeton, how many press conferences did he did at the NCAA tournament where all of the reporters in the room, outside of maybe two or three, had never seen what lacrosse was? So Bill Tierney had this kind of advocacy role for the sport that, you know, we talk about it a lot, but I don't even think we know the half of how much he was influential in terms of showcasing and growing the sport.
Kevin, you were also in attendance at his announcement press conference and kind of attack the other angle, which is really important and significant. What's next? And he made it very clear what he wants next to be. What did he say?
Yeah, he wants my namesake, Matt Brown, to be the next head coach of Denver University lacrosse. And it makes sense. You know, he's been there with them since the onset, and he's been in charge of the offense, been in charge of the recruiting. Really, there's no better person to pass the baton off to in-house. So it does seem like they will do a search or a process after the season is complete for all intents and purposes. But Matt Brown is kind of he's ingrained in the Denver culture as both coach and player, and Bill Tierney was adamant that he's going to politicize and bargain for him to replace him.
I think adamant is even selling it short, Kevin. I think he went on about a 20-minute discussion about all of the reasons why Matt Brown should be the next head coach at Denver. So if there's anyone who knows how to pull the strings and make that happen and do some good advocating, it's going to be Bill Tierney.
Well, that's a perfect segue or foundation for one of my favorite Bill Tierney. It's not even a story because it's just a quip. I don't really even remember what we were talking about. And no exaggeration, I could have said this to him around 10 to 15 different conversations that we had. But I finally mustered up the courage to say something that I had been wanting to say to him for a very long time, which was, "You are the most Machiavellian person in the sport." And what did he say? "Thank you." Which was awesome. Like, I am somebody who loves politics. Matt, you majored in political science. Like, I love political maneuvering. If you can pull off some sort of, like, three-card Monte situation and have it be to your benefit, like, I just tip my cap to you and walk the other way. Like, it's fantastic. And obviously, he spent a career developing a reputation for politically influencing referees. But the thing about his approach that is so appreciated is that he is equal parts thoughtful, humble, and calculating. And what the Catholic guilt, but also person that shows up to mass, you know, every day can appreciate in me is it's not all ego driven and it's not all for his own benefit, right? And I think that to your point about he's the consummate coach, the thing is that he serves his players. He serves his team. And I can't say that. I didn't play for him. But I know dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of players. And for me, the thing that is among the most illustrative of how impactful he is as a coach is in the 2011 Final Four, in the 2012 Final Four, in the 2013 and 15 Final Four, there were as many Princeton lacrosse alums in the Denver fan section as there were Denver lacrosse fans. And that was so informative because these were guys who felt like essentially they owed so much of their life and livelihood to one guy. And ultimately, when you think about the nature of college coaching and what you're supposed to do, like, that's a big part of it, right? It's not just about stewarding a team over 4 years when you're on campus. It's also about setting up your life to achieve the goals that you want to achieve. And I think that, you know, the Princeton Denver lacrosse alums that I know that played for him regard him as highly as possible when it comes to those missions. And I think that ultimately that's his legacy, right? There's only one guy that's won a national championship at two different institutions. There are a lot of guys who have influenced many, many lives. There aren't many guys, and maybe there's only one, who have engendered as much loyalty in as many people for the role that they played in how their lifestyle has developed.
Terry, one last thing on Coach Tierney before we move on to other things. I remember you had a post-it note on your computer that, what was it, that Denver will win a national championship by 20... What was that, the backstory on that?
Yeah, all right. So when they beat the U.S. national team in... it was the 2012 Spring Classic, right? So the Fall Classic we're familiar with. There was an event, you know, it had no longer kind of has the same continuity that it had for a long time. But the U.S. national team played a college team at IMG in January, like a bunch of times in a row. And if memory serves, Duke lost in 2010, I think. And then they went on to win the national championship. And that year, the U.S. national team went on to win gold medal in Manchester. Denver beat the U.S. men's team in 2012. And Mark Matthews was incredible, and Alex Demopoulos was, like, throwing dimes, and Chase Carrero was winning face-offs, and I was just like, this team's going to win a national championship. And Andy Bilallo was at Inside the Cross at the time, and I came in after watching that game and made some outrageous comment about how they were going to win the national championship, probably that year. And then I've had moments like this in my outrageous sports take days in the past, specifically with reference to the 2007 Ohio State national runner-up basketball team, which, yes, I won $50 from Pat McCadden because I originally said they were going to win the national championship and then managed to reel that back and say that they were going to play for a national championship, and that's what they did because they did not win. They did not beat Florida. They did beat Georgetown in the Final Four. They did not beat Florida in the national championship game. Didn't matter. But yeah, no. So it was on the monitor right there with a couple other important messages to be reminded of. And I don't know if it said before 2015 what it said. I might have been late. I might have been a year late, honestly, because a lot of the guys that were contributors on that team ended up not coming to fruition. But yeah, if I was a year late, they were certainly not, because that was an incredible run that they put on. And Wes Berg, man, he's still slinging it.
Well, you still get some credit for that prediction, even if you were a year late.
So, speaking of being a year late, if you missed everything that happened since June 1st, we're going to run through some of the more significant storylines. Matt Kinnear put together a full recap on InsideLacrosse.com on January 4th, right when we all came back from our holiday food-induced malaise. And let's start by going through. The 2023 championship games will be held on the men's side, Division 1, 2, and 3, at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia. On semifinals will be on Saturday, May 27th. D2 and D3 championship will be on Sunday, May 28th. And the D1 championship will be on Monday, May 29th. The quarterfinals will be a week earlier. On Saturday, the two quarterfinal games will be played in Albany at Casey Stadium on May 20th. And on Sunday, quarterfinals, will be played at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium in Annapolis. The women's championship will take place at Wake Med Soccer Park in Cary, North Carolina on May 26th and 28th. The D2 championship will be played at Key Stadium in Indianapolis. And the D3 championship, as has been the case for a long time, will be played at Kerr Stadium in Salem, Virginia. We have two new men's Division I programs, both transitioning from Division II, Lindenwood, based in St. Charles, Missouri, and Queens, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. On the women's side, there are seven teams making their debut. In addition to Queens and Lindenwood, Stonehill makes its transition from D2. They will join the NEC. Fairley Dickinson in New Jersey makes its debut. And then on top of that, Eastern Michigan and Xavier out in Ohio and Michigan, respectively. And then most prominently, Clemson joins the ACC as the newest and most high-profile rival in the women's D1 circuit. This is the part that we are going to dive into a little bit more. The conference realignment situation was absolutely ridiculous. 21 teams are in new conferences. Now in the America East, Bryant, Merrimack, and NGAT. Now in the A Sun, Jacksonville, Lindenwood, Mercer, and Queens. In the CAA, Hampton, Monmouth, Stony Brook. In the MAC, LIU, Mount St. Mary, Sacred Heart, VMI, and Wagner. And the new look A10, completely new, High Point, Hobart, Richmond, St. Joe's, St. Bonaventure, and UMass. Matt Kinnear, we've got a lot going on here. What do you have to say about everything that's happened in this conference realignment spectrum?
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of those conference realignment is one of those stories that I feel like does not get the attention it deserves in the moment. And then, you know, kind of people just kind of catch, this is exactly what this kind of post is for. People realize it in January or February that, oh my gosh, all these teams are in new places. Particularly this year, because it doesn't really involve, you know, these are all the mid-major conferences, so to speak. You know, so the ACC, the Big Ten, the Big East, you know, those are all intact. So, you know, I don't think they necessarily get the headlines that all these moves that, you know, kind of one-off moves that happen in the aggregate. When you say it's 21 teams, I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that, you know, basically a third, 23 teams, basically a third of Division I lacrosse has moved, which is insane. But I think the major takeaway from this is A-10 lacrosse. You know, the A-10 has had women's lacrosse. You know, they've had sponsored women's lacrosse for a number of years. But, you know, this brings some really key rivalries that are going to really engage the student bodies on those campuses. You know, like a St. Joe's versus Wagner game, you know, this is no offense to anyone on any side. It just doesn't have the same cachet for those student bodies because they're not familiar with those opponents in any other sports. But when you talk about St. Joe's and Richmond in terms of their basketball legacies and what the campuses are familiar with, that's going to really bring a lot of excitement to all of these campuses when these games are played, when, you know, in each respective institution when they host these games. And the A-10 is really, really, really good, I think, is the big takeaway here, too. When you look at it, it's basically all successful teams from other conferences joined to make the A-10. So you look at St. Joseph's, who won the NEC. You look at Richmond, who won the SoCon, with High Point, who was right there with them and has kind of been neck and neck with them. Hobart was, you know, in the NEC championship game, or... yeah, was in the NEC championship game. St. Bonaventure in the MAC was number one in the regular season in the MAC. UMass is a team that, you know, consistently is the top of the CAA. So it's not like they compiled all these teams from random conferences that were stragglers, so to speak. They essentially took the best of the best of those mid-major conferences and put them all together, making one conference that's pretty much top to bottom really awesome.
A-10 pod.
I keep hyping.
Kevin, are you an A-10 stan?
I'm an A-10 stan. What can I say? Come on. Give me the High Point Richmond game. Give me the St. Joe's or St. Yeah, St. Joseph's and Richmond or Hobart and all these games. They're going to be sick. They're going to be great.
I'm an A-Sun stan. I'm an A-Sun stan because ultimately... the A-Sun changes the complexion of college lacrosse, right? For the last 3-4 years, we've had four independents that had no reasonable shot at making the NCAA tournament. And Ted Gumbart, the outgoing commissioner of the A-Sun, essentially said, enough. I'm not going to do that anymore. We are going to provide a solution. And not only are we going to, as a conference, provide a solution, but once we get two more teams and we get to 12, I've got this pocket conference over here and I'm gonna turn it into action. And there's gonna be CCSA lacrosse. We're gonna have another AQ. We're gonna have 18 teams and maybe even 20 teams in the NCAA tournament as a result. So to me, it's unfortunate that, you know, he decided now's the time to call it a career, because, you know, this is a guy that has no affiliation or connection to the sport, at least as far as I know. And he's doing for men's lacrosse what nobody has done. Literally nobody has done. Cleveland State, no conference home. Robert Morris, no conference home. Utah, no conference home. Like, just left out in the wilderness. And the A-Sun essentially said, like, that is not what college athletics are about. And we're going to provide a solution. And they did so in opposition to existing conference membership. Not their own, but others who resisted this. It's an incredible feat. And the fact that now any new Division I men's team doesn't have to worry about finding a conference home because the A-Sun's going to take them. And they only, if there are two, then it just means that there's going to be two new 16 conferences. It's a total game changer. Total game changer. And that's before you even get to the fact that now Hampton is a part of the CAA.
Yeah.
Conference realignment this offseason. Matt, to your point, nobody paid attention to it. And I can't fault them. Who cares, right?
Yeah.
Changes the complexion of the sport in incredible ways. Incredible ways.
It changes the complexion of the sport, but if, like, on the surface, if you're not following it that closely, it's the same amount of AQs this year. And, you know, again...
You're right. The NEC and the SoCon went away.
Mm-hmm. So, like,
we've got some really big conferences. We've got some 8, 9, 10 team conferences. There are a lot of teams that are playing a lot of conference opponents, which on the surface kind of sucks because it limits you in terms of your out-of-conference scheduling ability. But on the other hand, for a lot of these teams that were struggling to get home games, it's a really good thing because now you might get an additional one or two home games, which is a really good thing. So it actually cuts both ways.
Yeah, and another thing is, that, like you said, there are no independents in lacrosse right now. You know, every team has a conference home, which was true last year, but was true in a temporary fashion last year, not true in terms of, like, sustainable long-term, all those teams were going to have conference homes, given that what we knew about, you know, teams departing the NEC and stuff like that. So the NEC is no more, as you alluded to, and most of those teams... did, you know, kind of scatter. Some are in the A-10, some are in the America East, etc. But, Terry, to your point about the big conferences, one byproduct, that this is a very, very minor byproduct of this that I'm very excited about, is going to be midweek conference games that are going to exist later in the season, particularly in the MAC and the A-Sun are going to have some, I believe they're Wednesday night games, Wednesday afternoon games that happen during those later weeks of the season, which is just something that, you know, we have some great February midweek matchups, some great March midweek matchups, but then we get into the heart of the season where there's actually warm weather and people are interested in what's happening, and you can't really follow anything in the middle of the week because all the teams are scheduling Saturday to Saturday. So that is one thing that I am super excited about seeing come back.
Continuing on in terms of the other things that you may have missed since the last time you checked out InsideLacrosse.com, a lot of coaching changes. Again, similar to the conference realignment, we had Brad Ross taking over at Bryant from Mike Pressler, Jordan Levine at LIU, John Aderna at Manhattan, Ryan Danahy at Mercer, Eric Wolf at NJIT, Bobby Benson at Providence, Justin Turia at St. John's, and Drew Kelleher at UMass Lowell. A few of those were a little bit of reshuffling. Drew Kelleher took the UMass Lowell job, vacating Manhattan, which allowed John Aderna to be promoted. Jordan Levine taking over LIU as Eric Wolf left LIU to take over NJIT. Brad Ross obviously filling the shoes of his predecessor, the very substantial and without introduction needed Mike Pressler. Matt, these are 9 new head coaching jobs, if you include Chad Sermon, who is taking over Iona, a program that starts play in 2024. What was your reaction to any of these moves, and is there one that you think significantly moves the needle for its program?
Well, I don't know if moves the needle for its program is the right way, but in terms of Mike Pressler leaving was shocking, in terms of just how... you know, that was a rumor.
Well, it was shocking, kind of, except for the fact that we heard rumors after they lost to Virginia that he retired in the locker room.
Yeah, but that's kind of what makes it shocking, is I had heard the rumor that Mike Pressler retired for probably three seasons.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of a Boy Who Cried Wolf situation, in the sense that I just didn't believe that it was actually going to be something that really happened. But then, you know, him taking the high school job and just, you know, none of the people that I knew in the Bryant circles were expecting that, so to speak. I would have felt less shocked about it a year ago, or right after COVID, than I did last year. So that was certainly shocking. And, you know, Brad Ross is going to be a guy who is a great fit there. You know, he's a great lacrosse mind, and, you know, has enough of Pressler in him, but also has enough of his own way about him that I think it's going to be a really good mix. In terms of, you know, guys who can move the needle, so to speak, I really like what Drew Kelleher did at Manhattan, and I really think he can bring that to UMass Lowell. You know, I think at Manhattan he had a personal connection to Manhattan, you know, with his family having alums there, his grandfather and I believe his father were Manhattan alums. And he just really built a culture of caring, is what he called it. And I think that's something he could really get out of UMass Lowell pretty quickly on. He just has an ability to make the men in his program really care and buy in a significant way. And I think you'll see some pretty good improvement from UMass Lowell in the next few years. So I think he's definitely going to have a pretty quick, you know, I won't say turnaround. You know, I don't think we're going to see UMass Lowell winning a national championship anytime soon, but I think he's going to get enough buy-in that there's going to be, you know, significant incremental improvement from them.
Kevin, what do you think Bobby Benson's going to do at Providence?
Yeah, it's gonna be slow improvement, just like Keller, but it's got a foundation. He's got a lot of family ties at Providence, which makes it a good fit for him. And this is his chance to have his own chance to be the head coach. And, you know, he's playing another former Maryland offensive coordinator the first week of the season. Battle of the former Tillman OCs with Holy Cross and JL Repert. But I think the outlook is good for the Friars with Bobby Benson after coaching one of the best offenses of all time last season.
And that's a Providence program that seems to have, like, everything in place to be successful. The facilities are fantastic there. You know, they're in a conference that's very good, but, you know, it doesn't seem... You know, there's been a blueprint for teams succeeding in the Big East and kind of building programs that are successful. I mean, look at the success that Marquette had winning back-to-back years, you know, being a pretty new program. You know, there's no reason why they can't be at least competing regular to be in the Big East tournament and then see what happens from there. Whereas, you know, it's felt in, you know, recent times that, you know, their spot as, like, the fourth, fifth team was more at stake than in terms of... you know, them being consistently in the
Yeah, I would agree. It'll be an interesting progression and an interesting build, particularly because, to me, what has always separated Bobby in terms of his approach and the causes for his success is that he's a non-conventional thinker, which, when you're an employee, which he has been for two of the strongest minded head coaches that have existed in this sport over the last 20 years, Dave Petromala from, 2007 to 2020, and then John Tillman in 21 and 22, you can imagine that essentially the reins are on, right? Insofar as, like, his job is to be the stalking horse. I'm going to say the most outrageous thing in order to get this otherwise relatively static operation to move in a direction that I think makes the most sense, right? Whereas when you are now fully in control and you're the one making the decisions, the biggest enemy is yourself in terms of how courageous are you going to be? How faithful are you going to be to your own ideas? And hopefully, I think if, in fact, being non-conventional is Bobby's strength, the reason that I anticipate and expect it to bear fruit and kind of find success, particularly early, is because he's not going to realize how non-conventional a lot of his approaches are. And who knows what it means in terms of what it manifests on the field. But it'll be exciting to watch. And to your point, Kevin, about, you know, the family ties, there's no doubt that, you know, there's a lot of equity on the home front. If he struggles it's going to be difficult to answer to answer the folks in his world who want to see the Friars put a good men's lacrosse product on the field. Continuing on in terms of other significant developments this offseason, there are some new rules, and not as many or as significant new rules as there have been in years past. We don't have a new shot clock, a new shot clock reset. We don't have a new mechanic for the face-off. Can you believe it? They're what? Letting the face-off go as it has been for the last couple of years.
Bring back the motorcycle grip.
That's crazy. McNair, we do have two new elements. So the first is adjudication for crease calls. And we also have an emphasis on how to administer penalties for hits to the head. What are the impacts on games that you think fans should be prepared for?
Well, I mean, the plays around the crease are going to be a discussion in college lacrosse for eternity. Like, there's never going to be a...
We could just get rid of the dive.
Well, go back to... Take a time machine back to 1998 or whatever.
They tried that.
They tried it and people freaked out about it for two decades for them to get it back in, or for a decade for them to get it back in. But the thing we're going to, like we saw it in the Penn-Rutgers quarterfinal game, was I think probably the highest profile. It's really when you see something happen in the NCAA tournament is when you get that like kind of critical mass of people like realize that, oh, this is something that's problematic. And I apologize, I don't remember who the players were. But basically, you came to that point where, the offensive player is basically hit into the crease by a defender. It's better for the defender to just hit the guy into the crease because they know that it's going to come back. And as opposed to now, with the new rule, they are not going to disallow a goal in that situation. So before, it was just creating a situation where the defender was incentivized to just, you know what, I'm going to hit this guy into my goalie. And, we'll take the penalty and go
right back. And into the goal mouth more specifically. Yeah.
Right. So obviously, the obvious concerns there are, a guy just scored a goal, like give him the goal is like kind of the common sense logic there, but also the injury concerns, you might hurt your own goalie in that situation by hitting a diving attackman into him. So this alleviates that. And I think that's going to be the most significant thing, because I think you were seeing it more and more as a, this is what they were taught to do in that situation is, to hit the guy into the crease because, we'll take the penalty and we'll go from there. We trust our man down unit. Let's do it.
Kevin, what is your expectation for how the hits to the head being more clearly administered as 1 minute, 2 minute, or 3 minute are going to come to fruition? Like, do you think that refs are actually going to do this and utilize this?
For sure. Yeah, I think it's been a point of emphasis to increase player safety, obviously, with the last couple decades, especially in football, but also in lacrosse here. But no team wants a 3 minute penalty. And if you're getting that slapped on you, then you're going to definitely be dissuaded to have that kind of physicality in some of the heated rivalries we'll see throughout the season. But whether the refs will adhere to kind of the criteria laid out to them, I mean, they better, right?
I mean, it's funny you say that. Go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say, just reading it, like, to me, it's pretty clear. Like, I think it's pretty clear and decisive in the language that they used. I'll read it I think it's worth people hearing. Because, again, I think this is something, because it wasn't, like, because there wasn't a change to the face-off, I don't think the rule changes got that much attention this offseason. So, the more defined penalty structure is players who make indirect contact to an opponent's head or neck will receive a 1 minute penalty. Players who make direct contact to an opponent's head or neck will receive a 2 minute penalty. Players who make excessive contact to an opponent's head or neck will receive a 3 minute penalty. Now, to me, I can imagine all of those situations in my head. Obviously, when you get indirect versus direct, I think there is some...
That's pretty clear.
Yeah, but I can imagine, I can clearly see that picture in my head.
Excessive seems a little bit more subjective. But ultimately, I think what this is, and Kevin, to your point about they better, like, I actually see it the opposite way, where it's like, now they can't. This is about giving the referees a permission structure to adjudicate more severe penalties. It's funny, like, our colleague our colleague Patrick McEwen, I think, has done a good job of essentially, I don't know, I don't want to sound like a Philistine. I'm not trying to say that there is no room for contact in lacrosse, but I also think that it's worth it to point out what level of contact is necessary in order for the game to be faithful to the game that you see so often. Because when you watch a well-played college lacrosse game, there is comparatively very little contact. When you watch a poorly played game, there's a lot more contact. And so as a result, you can make a relatively cogent argument that, like, college lacrosse, or in really high-level lacrosse, like, contact isn't that important. So the point is that if it is unsafe, for whatever, and that can manifest in any number of ways, but if it is unsafe, then it should be adjudicated out. And I think the sport did a tremendous job from 2009 to 2011 or 12 creating rules that actually eliminated a lot of unsafe contact. But I think that for the last 10 years, it's been relatively plateaued. And I think that, Patrick made this point, this represents another step forward. And the reason it does is because ultimately, and I love this conversation when it comes to the NFL, it's like the NFL has become a lot safer because the rules that people hate have started to be followed. And that's what happens. That's the whole point, right? Like, players adjust to the rules and the way in which they are called. And so it requires referees to actually call them in a way that is punitive to their team and to the outcome of the game in order for them to adjust their behavior. And it's not to say that there won't be mistakes. I hate the college football targeting rule because of the way in which it punishes players for doing things that they didn't intend to do. But at the same point, punishing based not on intent but on outcome is meant to create conditions where players don't do dangerous things disregarding the potential outcome. And I think that in lacrosse, we're at a point where that's what the sport's ready for. And we'll see how it manifests during the season.
Which, a violent hit to the head is always going to be less cool, so to speak, than just a absolute clean hit to the chest. You know, I don't know where I was going with that other than that.
You're a rule follower.
So, only a couple more things we want to get to in terms of what has happened since last offseason. The transfer portal is always very active and hard to follow. Not public is one of the reasons that it's hard to follow. A lot of transfers occurred. I want to start by talking about transfers that have not yet occurred, which is that a good percentage of Princeton's class of 2023 has already entered the portal. I believe 8 or 9 players have said that they intend to transfer after this season. We have heard quiet rumblings around where a number of these players intend to enroll, but I haven't heard anything definitive in terms of the decisions yet. We're talking about guys like Sammy English, Jake Stevens, Alex Slusher, Bo Peterson, Jake Stabner, Griffin Rackauer. So a lot of really high-profile players. Coulter McAsee, I believe, is in as well. But, you know, that represents maybe this podcast next year. In terms of, we're bringing you up to speed on where those guys enrolled. All we know now is that they have entered the portal. As it pertains to guys who are in new locations, I think we're all in agreement that Tucker Dordovic being at Georgetown is the most significant offseason transfer. And then most recently, Marcus Hudgens, an undergrad transfer from Army with 2 years of eligibility remaining, enrolled at Ohio State and has received his eligibility waiver, so he is good to go. He and Richie Lacalandra from LIU were in similar situations, and Richie is good to go as well. Matt Kinnear, you put out our top 15 most impactful transfer rankings just a few weeks ago. What say you about the transfer portal?
Yeah, I it's funny with Dordovic, and you know, I was actually just having this conversation about those rankings, and I want to kind of take back one of them that I did in there. So that's why I stumbled a little bit there. Is I had Will Mark in there as kind of impact transfer, and the way that I did it was just limiting it to one per school. But when I'm kind of looking back at it, you know, I don't think he's going to be the impact transfer in that Syracuse group. I think it's going to be Alex Simmons and what he can provide for that offense. So that's kind of one maybe alteration that I have from that group. But to me, it's, you know, we had Tucker Dordovic as our number one in our Georgetown as our number one in the class transfer ratings early in the year. And then I'm kind of really coming around on Ohio State in terms of I've been really high on them, you know, all off season. And with Hudgens and Van Buren back there, like Ohio State's defense is going to be absolutely absurd. The way that they trust their guy when they're below GLE, and now you have a guy like Hudgens or Van Buren who can be that guy to just, you know, Nick Myers, let them just go one-on-one. That's a tremendous game changer for Ohio State. So I really think that Hudgens being, you know, we knew about Hudgens, and Hudgens was, you know, talking about going to Ohio State for several months now. But the fact that it is now, there was some doubt in terms of if he was going to be able to play this year. The fact that he is able to, and La Calandra, it really, really, really has me kind of going all in on the Buckeyes right now.
Kevin, a couple other significant transfers. Two heading from Yale to Notre Dame as a package deal, Brian Tevlin and Chris Fake. How do you feel like they're going to impact the Fighting Irish?
Well, their impact was immediate coming on the fall semester. Brian Tevlin's leadership was really felt. They put together, Tevlin led a players-only sixes tournament where they drafted four teams within the roster, and they had a really cool 5-week, once a week, playing this sixes, hidden conditioning kind of tournament, and it's evident Tevlin's going to have he's already been elected co-captain, and it's clear that he's going to have the leadership quality that he did at Yale, and we all know the two-way athleticism and midfield ability he has, and Chris Fake, he's a great cover man, and he's doing a great job on another Chris Kavanaugh during the fall. So they're going to be great for the Irish for sure.
Terry, I want to highlight one transfer class that I don't think got as much attention as maybe, you know, they're certainly not on par with the Georgetown that brings in so many guys, you know, bringing in Solomon and Dordovic and Minikis and all these guys who are just big name players and Hinks. But UMass is sneakily an awesome transfer group right now. And, you know, you can probably expect some good things at UMass with what they've got. You know, for instance, you know, Campbell, the defenseman that they have is Chris Campbell. He's from LIU. He was, you know, one of the best defenders in the NEC. So you add him to a team that already has, you know, an elite goaltender, a goalie who can probably play at an All-America level. And that's, you know, that's a really good add that they have there. Connor Foley is a player who looked really good for Ireland in the U21 games. He was at UMass Lowell. Will Abbott is a kind of a proven guy who played for Quinnipiac. You know, so none of these guys are like big name major school guys, but in the aggregate, they really just make a UMass team better and deeper and just solid at every position. So UMass is a kind of a group to watch.
A10 Stan, that's what this podcast is all about.
That's right. And my boy Logan McGovern at UNC. I mean, Terry, you're the only one who's actually seen UNC play in person. Granted, there were some injuries and, you know, it was fall ball, so it's not too much to get out of that. I listed Logan McGovern as kind of their impact transfer in that class. Would you agree, or is there someone else who rises above him?
I would definitely agree in the sense that, like, I don't think any of their guys actually played. Like, their entire first midfield, which I think featured two of those guys, were out due to injury. And then everybody's favorite college lacrosse player, Sean Goldsmith, was out due to injury as well. So No, he played really well against Harvard at Georgetown Prep in the fall. You know, certainly Dewey Egan was kind of unmistakable, and Lance Tillman demonstrated like his capacity and ability to be that quarterback. But McGovern filled the lefty attackman goal scorer role very aptly and showed that he can do that, and this offense can be an effective college lacrosse offense for sure. So, yeah, I think that you should expect that he's going to be able to produce at the level that you anticipate he will. It is interesting. I do think that there's, you know, one, I believe, Bryant transfer that we haven't talked a ton about because he's an undergrad, in Ben Albadian at Cornell, who's, yeah, who's going to be an interesting one in terms of, you know, how he gets on the field, what role he fills, et cetera, because, you know, there are a couple spots in that offense that somebody could slide into. And given the fact that we have high expectations for that team, whether or not that ends up happening is going to be meaningful based on how good we think they're going to be.
Yeah, and in the realm of, you know, Penn State, I'm going to kind of talk about Penn State here because they're one of the biggest brands in, you know, the biggest athletic
college athletics.
College athletics brands we have, you know, particularly in lacrosse, you know, it's funny. I think sometimes we forget how, no pun intended, how big these Big Ten brands are. But Penn State had one of the weirdest years last year. Just the way that, they beat Yale, and then they had, like, these head-scratching losses. And just, you know, they suffered some injuries. So it was just kind of a strange, disappointing year for them. And this year, they have this odd mix because of the transfer portal and because of returning from injury, where they improved in a lot of areas that they needed to improve in. They're really old, but they're not old in terms of guys who have played a lot of years and minutes for Penn State. So I find it incredibly difficult to assess how they're going to be. But Chase Mullins, you know, taking faceoffs, you know, they were, you know, they were certainly not a good faceoff team last year. And if they can get that number nearing 50%, that's a huge win. And then, you know, when you consider, you know, the guys that they have at attack, you know, well, they have TJ Malone and Jack Traynor back. But you add in someone like Kevin Winkoff and Chris Jordan, who's a St. Lawrence player at attack. Again, these are guys who are experienced players. What's that?
Men,
yeah, exactly. They're experienced, a lot of minutes, size, all the stuff that you want in a player have joined this team. So I don't know how it's going to shake out, but I think it's like easy to kind of maybe disregard Penn State after the year they had last year and not realize how new but seasoned that they are heading into 2023.
I gave them very serious consideration for the 20th spot in my preseason poll. So if they end up being very good, I'm going to use this as my claim that I was not surprised. But that's a good place to end this because we started tonight. And again, it's Thursday. We recorded this on Monday night. So forgive us if anything enormous has happened in college lacrosse over the last 72 hours that we were not able to address. But we started Monday night by talking about the preseason top 20, and Penn State didn't come up in that conversation. So good place to end. Appreciate everybody listening. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review. We'll be back next week with more of The Source as we head into the 2023 season. And before you know it, we are going to be into our in-season college lacrosse podcast schedule. So can't wait. Look forward to it and appreciate your time, Matt and Kevin. We'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.